Hi, everybody. This is Gary Sandy, and thank you very much for listening to the WKRP cast.
So just sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide, and say...
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
Are you awake? Whoa! Are you awake now?
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Say what?
Dear God, she's going to kill us all.
Welcome to the WKRP cast. My name is Alan Stair.
And I'm Donna Stair. This is the fourth and final season of our week-by-week, episode-by-episode rewatch.
Join us for this final season as we're getting into the music,
the trivia, and the fun of WKRP.
So, fellow babies, stay tuned and stay cool. It's time for the WKRP cast.
I'm a WKRP in Cincinnati.
Welcome back to another WKRP cast. This week, we're heading in for some tests. What's our episode, Donna?
We're ready to discuss Straight from the Heart. The air date was November 4th, 1981. Written by Dan Gunselman. Story editor, Lisa Levin. Executive story consultants, Steve Marshall and Dan Gunselman. Directed by Dan Gunselman. Les is being given an award for a news broadcast. Herb is going on vacation, but Jennifer is worried when Herb takes his insurance papers with him. He checks into a hospital for heart tests and asks Les to stay with him. They then go to a porn movie. A 3D porn movie.
This one has a madcap feel to it. Every scene, they're somewhere else.
Yes.
They're just running around all over the place. It's fun and it's got a weird energy to it. Checking in on the title of this one, anything coming straight from the heart is considered warm and sincere. The phrase can be found in French literature dating back to the 1800s. In pop culture, Bryan Adams and Bonnie Raitt will both have hits with a song called Straight from the Heart, but that won't be for a couple of years. In 1981, we did find one interesting pop culture reference to this phrase. In August of 81, the Allman Brothers had their last top 40 hit with a song called Straight from the Heart. It was a minor hit off their Brothers of the Road album. The single would only peak at number 39, so barely breaking into the top 40.
Could you take a chance one more time?
Could a WKRP writer have had an Allman Brothers cassette in their car? We'd say it's pretty possible.
Did you catch the name of our director? It's Dan Gunselman.
This is the Dan Gunselman Show.
It sure is. Dan joined the crew at WKRP in the second season as a story editor. He will work on 58 WKRP episodes, either as a writer, story editor, or producer. This is one of only two episodes he will direct for WKRP, and this one is pretty big. This is Dan Gunselman's first ever directing gig on any project. Not only did he direct it, he also wrote it. Or wrote it as much as Hugh Wilson will let anybody write an episode. Dan will eventually rack up directing credits on six different shows. He also directs the upcoming Who's On First as a bookend to this episode. In 1986, Dan will direct a single episode of Growing Pains. Then, starting in 1988, he directs nine episodes of Just the Ten of Us. Dan is primarily a writer-producer. He works as executive producer on Just the Ten of Us and Growing Pains for more than 170 combined episodes. Dan, you might remember, also marries WKRP story consultant and writer Lisa Levin in 1983.
So it's time to head into Gunselman world. We start out this time in the studio, so you know what that means. We've got a poster watch.
Yay!
Now, we've already seen several of these in Rumors, so it's not a huge poster watch, but we do have a few new things to discuss.
Rodney Crowell is gone from the studio door. In his place is a poster for U.S. jazz singer Al Jarreau. This is promoting his 1981 album, Breakin' Away. Breakin' Away was released June 30th of 1981. It will spend more than 2 years on the Billboard album chart, becoming Jarreau's most popular and best-selling album. Four singles charted from Breakin' Away. The first was the most popular. We're In This Love Together would spend 24 total weeks on the U.S. Hot 100, peaking at number 15.
And we're in this love together. We got the kind that lasts forever. We're in this love together. And like berries on the vine, it gets sweeter.
The album will win Best Pop Vocal Performance, Male, at the 1982 Grammys, and it's also nominated for Album of the Year. If you aren't placing this album, you might also remember Al Jarreau as the guy who sang the theme to Moonlighting.
Somebody by night.
Passed away in 2017 at the age of 76.
Under the studio window, you can just get a glimpse of a poster for U.S.-born, U.K.-raised new wave performer Lenny Lovitch. Lovitch was born in Detroit in 1949, but she moved to the U.K. when she was only 13. Lovitch achieved commercial success in the U.K., but was never quite able to crack the U.S. market. This poster is promoting a 1981 EP called New Toy. It was a release specifically targeted to the U.S. The EP contained six songs. The title track, New Toy, was released as a single. It had been written specifically for Lovitch by Thomas Dolby. Dolby says he wrote the song as an ode to his new synthesizer, a Fairlight CMI digital workstation. Make the U.S. Hot 100, but New Toy did show up on the Billboard Hot Dance Club Songs chart, peaking at number 19.
Over the Cincinnati map, behind Johnny, is the poster for Dynasty. We saw this one last time. In Rumors, it was on the back of the door coming from the studio hallway into the bullpen.
If you look through the window into the production room, you can see a yellow poster on the production room door with the word Jamaica across the top in red. We were at a loss on this one, so we threw it to Michael Hernandez, the account of Rock. Even for Hernandez, this was a toughie. Neither of us ever found the poster, but Michael did locate the same graphic on the album cover for Jamaica Reggae Sunsplash 4. Sunsplash was Jamaica's annual music festival and celebration of reggae. The best performances were gathered together for each year's album. This one, 4, was released in the summer of 1981.
Jaja is a ruler, don't make nobody fool ya. Jaja is a ruler.
Let's get on in to the studio where Les is at the mic. Johnny is sitting on a stool reading a Billboard magazine. Venus is rifling through a stack of albums. He pulls out the Yellow Jackets album and puts it on the turntable. It looks like Venus might actually be cueing a record with headphones.
No.
In the first shot, he's got a single cup headphone over his head with the cord hanging down his front. But then, oh, nope. The first time we cut away from Les, the headphones have disappeared, and we don't see them again the entire scene. No Venus's vibin' threads here. He's looking very casual and subdued, wearing gray pants and a greenish knit V-neck sweater with a gold chain.
Would you say classy, but not vibin'? He still looks good. They're just
Oh, he always looks good.
These just aren't really that over-the-top
right.
flytrap kind of...
They don't... They don't pop out at you like some of his outfits, but he still looks very classy.
And now a special look at this episode's bandage placement for the 5-time Buckeye Newshawk Award winner, Les Nessman. This is the Les Nessman Bandage Report. Now, here's Donna Stair with her report about Les Nessman.
Left pinky finger.
This has been a look at the bandage placement for Silver Sow and Copper Cob award-winning journalist Les Nessman.
Less is reporting on the forced closing of two more adult theaters.
Captain Ernest T. Gibbs, head of the Porn Patrol, had this to say about the progress of the raids.
There's been a crackdown. Less puts a cartridge into the control board to play the report.
Hoo-wee, that's good bacon. Sweet and smoky with a whole hog taste.
Porker's Paradise, snub-nose slap.
Oops. It's the wrong cartridge. That does happen. You get your cart stacked out of order, and suddenly your actualities are in the wrong stories. It really does happen.
Now, hold on a minute. Porker's Paradise? This is a callback to the hilarious Purveyors of Pork-Like Products storyline from the Venus Rising episode. Herb must still be working off that trade of 200 ham-like meat products.
This stuff is... Well, it's not exactly real meat.
What is that?
I don't know. But it can't spoil.
One of the funniest storylines in the whole series for me. I love that so much. So Johnny and Venus are chuckling because Les is having so much trouble. Les quickly pulls the cart out of the player and he throws it across the room. He almost hits Venus right in the head.
As Les is tossing carts around the booth, let's talk carts. They're formerly known as Fidelipack cartridges or the NAB cartridge. Very few people in a radio station would ever know those names. In stations, they were just carts. First introduced in 1959, carts were used extensively in radio into the 1990s. There's been a lot of talk on the WKRP Facebook pages about the difference between radio station cartridges, the popular 4-inch version, and 8-track tapes. Take note, fellow babies, there is a huge difference.
8-tracks, those things you had jammed under your car seat in the 70s, were never used in a radio station, ever. 8-tracks sound terrible when compared to the output of a cartridge. One of the biggest differences is mechanical. 8-tracks have a built-in floating pinch roller inside the body of the tape case. A cart, like what Les is using, doesn't have a built-in pinch roller. From a fidelity standpoint, the built-in pinch roller is considered a dumb design. When you push play on a cart machine, a real pinch roller swings up from inside the machine. It goes through a hole in the bottom of the cart and provides a stabilizing pressure behind the tape. This means when a cart is playing, it is mechanically held in place by the pinch roller.
Carts also sounded better because they moved twice as fast as 8-tracks at the industry standard, 7.5 inches per second. Carts use 1/4-inch 2-track tape. 8-tracks, as the name implies, are cramming 4 stereo channels, 8 total tracks, onto the same 1/4-inch tape. Smaller tracks mean less sound information and lower quality sound. Now, don't be confused, fellow babies. 8-tracks in the car, carts in the station. And I remember my 8-track tape player. I had one at home and my stereo. We also had it in the car when I was driving.
And the sound was horrible. But thin and tinny.
Yes.
And,
well, I didn't notice that as much because, you know, it was just cool that I was driving and listening to my Beatles.
Well, and you probably had like a 4-inch Buck 89 speaker in the dash that you were listening to it through, so you didn't notice the bad output from the 8-track.
Do you remember the tracks when they would change from one track to the other? Sometimes it was in the middle of a song and the song would be playing along and you'd hear this kerchunk.
I remember riding in a buddy's VW microbus where he had just installed an 8-track player. And he was so proud of it, he had dubbed off his album of Bat Outta Hell, which Bat Outta Hell has 7- and 8-minute songs on it. It's really these long, epic songs. And in the middle of Bat Outta Hell, Jim Steinman and Meatloaf just going nuts, and all of a sudden, ka-chunk. And it would stop for like 3 seconds, and then the song would start again right at the point where it changed
tracks. And then if you were listening to the radio and you were hearing that song, you were waiting for the kerchunk because you were used to it.
You had heard it so many times, playing it over and over and over. But I've seen comments on the Facebook page, people saying, oh yeah, radio stations used to use 8-tracks. No, radio stations never, ever used 8-tracks. Those things looked like 8-tracks, but very different. So Les continues his report.
Moving from porn to corn, the Free Farmers Foundation of Omaha, Nebraska, finally made public today the name of this year's winner of their highest award in conservative agrarian broadcasting, the Copper Cob Trophy.
Les turns and smiles at Venus proudly. I had no idea all of these awards were out there for news people. He goes on.
I was quite surprised when Mr. Jimmy Lee Watson, president of these plowing patriots, called and told me...
So Les starts a new audio clip.
All purveyors of obscenity will be exposed for what they really are.
Les rips this cartridge out of the machine and tosses it behind him kind of violently. Johnny and Venus are really enjoying Les's newscast.
Poor Les, he just can't quite get it together. He tries to continue when Venus gets up and taps him on the shoulder. Venus points to his watch. Les finishes up his report talking quickly.
Mr. Jimmy Lee Watson went on to say that yours truly, this reporter, Les Nessman, will receive the highly prized Copper Cop tomorrow at the Free Farmers Foundation Awards Luncheon in festive Omaha, Nebraska. Well done, Les. This is Les Nessman reporting.
Les is a nervous wreck and very flustered. He knocks cartridges off the table looking for his closing cart.
Not questioning your professionalism or anything, Mr. Nessman, but it's common practice to have the cart in the deck before you need it.
Realizing there's dead air, Venus hurries over and starts a record. We hear Matinee Idol by Yellow Jackets.
We met the Yellow Jackets last time. We saw their big poster in the hallway outside of the studio during Rumors. And as we'll see in just a few minutes, it's still there. The Yellow Jackets seem to be going for the full WKRP promo package. If you check the console, that all-yellow record sleeve that Venus pulled is their first album. No hits off of it, but some great modern jazz from the still-performing Yellow Jackets.
Venus turns to Johnny as he sarcastically tells Les, nice work.
You can always tell a pro by the way he covers his technical errors.
Les, arms full of cartridges, misses the sarcasm.
Thanks. I won't be able to play poker tonight with you fellas.
He tells Venus and Johnny he's flying to Omaha for the awards presentation. He casually leans on the cart rack, smiling.
Success has its high price, Les.
Les giggles, and then he loses his balance, causing the cart rack to fall over, and cartridges spill out onto the floor, with Les falling on top of them.
What a mess! So what Les knocked over is one of the most uniquely radio station pieces of furniture you're ever likely to find. It's a round cart rack, sometimes called a cart carousel. It's specifically designed to hold those 4-inch NAB cartridges we were talking about. This cart rack is new at WKRP. We saw it in the studio for the first time during the last episode, Rumors. If you check Explosive Affair, it's not there. Instead, the carts were stored in a flat wall mount over in the same spot where they now have this revolving rack. Having Les knock it over feels like our writer's room thing. Hey, we've got this thing now. What do you want to do with it? From a story standpoint, maybe this is Andy spending some of those station upgrade dollars. We're betting Les has a big job ahead of him reloading the cart rack. Most cart racks were very organized, usually stored numerically, so the DJ could find the specific cart they needed when it came up on the spot log.
As we cut into the bullpen, we notice they've finally changed the posters in the hallway. Juice Newton is gone, and it's time for a bullpen poster watch.
Yay! The intense-looking guy to the right of the bullpen door is Ian Hunter. He's the one with the unruly curls and cool sunglasses. He was born Ian Hunter Patterson in Shropshire, England, in June of 1939. Hunter is best known as the frontman for early 70s band Mott the Hoople.
Television man is crazy, sam with juvenile delinquent wrecks. Oh, man, I need TV when I got T-Rex. Oh, brother, you get, I'm a good man.
Oh, the young dudes.
Hey, dudes.
Carry the news.
Where are you?
Hunter had an extensive solo career. This is a poster for his fifth studio album, 1981's Short Back and Sides. Hunter collaborated with Mick Jones on this one. He gave the songs more of an edge. There were no hits, but an all-star lineup of guest vocalists, including Todd Rundgren, Mick Ronson, and Ellen Foley.
To the left of the bullpen door is a poster for another Fleetwood Mac solo project. This is Stevie Nicks' debut solo album, Belladonna. This album was so hot, we're surprised the poster isn't glowing. It was released in July of 1981. Within 3 months, it was certified platinum. By 1990, it was certified quadruple platinum, with 4 million units shipped. It would spawn four singles. Stop Dragging My Heart Around was a duet with Tom Petty, who also wrote it. It would go to number 3 on the U.S. Hot 100. Leather and Lace was the second single. It was another duet, but this time with Don Henley.
I need you to love me. I need you today. Give to me your leather. Take from me my lace.
It will peak at number 6 on the Hot 100. The third single has become Stevie's signature, Edge of 17. Although it's one of her most enduring hits, Edge of 17 only peaks at number 11. The fourth and final single was a country-tinged number called After the Glitter Fades. Belladonna is included on the Billboard list of the 200 greatest albums of all time.
Jack Black has forever ruined Edge of 17 for me because of School of Rock. And taking Joan Cusack to that bar and getting her drunk and playing Edge of 17.
I remember that scene.
All I can think about now anytime I hear that song.
Great movie, though.
Oh, great movie. Transitioning to the bullpen, we find Herb going through drawers of the filing cabinet. He finds a folder and pulls a paper from it. Hearing Jennifer and Bailey coming down the hall, Herb quickly shuts the drawer. He shoves the paper back into his jacket pocket. And did you notice that jacket? I believe
it's time.
Herb Darlick, fashion alert.
Herb is wearing a shades of maroon and white plaid jacket, white dress shirt with a maroon, blue, and white diagonally striped tie. His pants are solid maroon polyester, and he has on his signature white belt and shoes.
This, to me, seems like a light suit, like a summer weight suit.
You think?
Yeah, it's got that festive kind of feel to it also. It's the red and white check tablecloth.
Bailey and Jennifer enter the bullpen. Bailey is talking about some women's rights issue. Herb turns to them and smiles.
Ladies?
Herb starts to walk away, but his jacket is caught in the drawer. He causes a huge rip up the back of his coat as he is jerked back to the cabinet. Jennifer and Bailey are trying hard not to laugh. Jennifer tells Herb she thought he was getting an early start on his vacation. Herb is awkwardly tucking jacket parts into his pocket.
Last minute details. Well, I've got to go. Lucille has the kids in the car loaded in the suitcase.
Herb's a lousy liar. He has a very serious look on his face, and he does not sound like a guy going on vacation.
No, you know me. I work hard, then I play hard.
Herb pauses to look at Jennifer and Bailey for a second, really seriously. Then he heads out of the bullpen doors. Bailey and Jennifer are laughing as Herb walks down the hall and disappears.
What was he looking for?
Bailey heads over to the file drawers.
Herb used the famous phrase, "I work hard and I play hard." The origin of the phrase can be traced to 1884. It was written in an advertisement for the Racine Episcopal Preparatory School in Racine, Wisconsin. The phrase is attributed to the school's first warden, James DeCoven, who famously said at Racine, "We work hard, play hard, pray hard."
And over the years, the pray hard has been dropped off of that phrase. Les enters the bullpen from the studio hallway door. He's smiling as he walks to his desk. Jennifer smiles back and asks how he's doing.
Humbled and honored, Jennifer, and yet grateful to my great many regular listeners.
Les goes on into his office. Bailey turns to Jennifer.
He took his hospital insurance forms on his vacation.
Oh, you know her. He works hard, then he plays hard.
Bailey agrees with Jennifer and walks on over to her desk.
Les asks them where Herb is. Jennifer says, oh, Herb left.
Left? He was supposed to get my plane ticket to Omaha. He told me he could get a good price.
Jennifer says maybe he just forgot. Les is panicking, and he's going through Herb's desk drawers. Les tells Jennifer it's the only way for him to get to Omaha on time. Les is taking things out of Herb's drawers and throwing them on top of the desk.
And we know how comfortable Les is with going through Herb's desk, so not a big deal for him. We did have to check in on Cincy to Omaha. It's about 720 miles. It's practically an 11-hour drive.
Yep, I'd rather fly.
Well, but there are no direct flights these days. American can have you there in just under 4 hours with one 40-minute stopover at O'Hare.
Finally, Les stands up. He's holding a yellow piece of paper.
Thank goodness. The Red-Eye to Omaha. Coach class.
Sounds enchanting.
Jennifer is reading another paper that was tossed up onto Herb's desk. Holding it over in front of Les, she tells him, look at this.
I, Herbert R. Tarlick, being of sound mind.
Les looks at Jennifer.
Who is he trying to kid?
All right, so do you think Herb's doing another trade with Jimmy the Gent for Les's tickets?
Think nine words. Jimmy the Gent Tartagliano's Bon Voyage House of Travel.
He could be. As Jennifer wonders what Herb is up to, we head into our theme.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
Come back from break in the lobby as the camera pans the lobby. Hey, construction continues. We see a ladder and paint drop cloths on the floor. The lobby is empty and the phone is ringing. Art opens his office door and peeks out. He has a fishing pole over his shoulder. He calls for Jennifer. There's no response. He walks on out into the lobby, and we see he's wearing fishing waders over his suit pants with boots. It is a good look. He's also wearing his shirt, tie, and suit vest.
It's a great visual.
Great visual. Putting the fishing pole down on Jennifer's desk, Art picks up the phone.
Hello, WKRP. Mr. Carlson? No, that's absolutely impossible. Well, we haven't been able to find him since we started redecorating the lobby.
Pardon?
Of course we're worried.
Do you think the writers periodically just say, we got to give Gordon a phone bit?
I think they do, because he's so good with the phone.
He is so fantastic with these phone bits. They give him one about every other episode. So Art hangs up the phone.
Mr. Carlson picks up his fishing pole, and as he heads back to his office, Jennifer comes into the lobby. She walks over to Mr. Carlson.
Is there anything wrong with Herb?
Mr. Carlson tells Jennifer, well, Herb could start taking his job a bit more seriously.
Of course, he's not the worst offender around here.
Jennifer looks down at Mr. Carlson's fishing waders and boots. Well, Mr. Carlson, seeing Jennifer's expression, starts to explain.
The only way you can break these hipsters in is by wearing them.
Mr. Carlson goes into his office.
Yeah, the pot calling the kettle black. The guy standing in the lobby in the fishing waders is saying somebody should take their job more seriously. So Jennifer hurries over to her desk, sits down, and starts looking through her Rolodex. Andy comes walking in. He's carrying a big box wrapped in paper. The texture of the paper looks a little like snakeskin. There's a cutout of a pink pig on each side of the present. It is a weird-looking thing.
What do you think, Jennifer?
I doubt he's going on vacation.
Huh?
No question as to who that's for.
Definitely for Les. Andy tells her no. The present. Jennifer takes a quick look, says it's nice, and goes back to her Rolodex.
For Les. Mark, the little guy's winning of the copper thingamajig.
Andy jokingly tells Jennifer it's a tie with no response. Andy can see Jennifer is distracted. He heads to Art's office to get him for the presentation of the present.
Did you see Andy's shirt? It says Cincinnati Zoo, and it has a picture of a gazelle head on it.
Pretty cool shirt, and unfortunately, Cincinnati Zoo, not a spot we were able to visit while we were in town.
We've got to go back.
I don't have to go back.
Jennifer has found the contact information she was searching for. She picks up the phone and dials.
Oh, hello, Lucille? This is Jennifer. I'm glad I caught you before you left. On your vacation. Right. We need a number where you'll be staying in case we have to call Herb. Well, have him call us then. Okay. Have fun.
Jennifer hangs up the phone and heads back to the bullpen.
I know she wasn't, but I love to think Edie McClurg was on the other end of that line.
Yes, I just love her.
So Art's office door opens. He walks out, followed by Andy, still holding the gift. Andy seems to have questioned Art's fashion choices.
Don't look silly when you're standing in the middle of an icy street.
Andy apologizes, saying he's sorry he said it.
Let's just give this to Les, all right?
The two of them head back to the bullpen, bickering like little old ladies.
We cut back to the bullpen, where Jennifer is standing with Les.
I knew it. Herb is ill.
Jennifer tells Les that Lucille always sounds a little strange.
Now don't go off half-cocked.
Les straightens up and looks at Jennifer.
A newsman is always fully cocked.
Les tells Jennifer he's calling hospitals, the cheapest one, first. Jennifer tells Les to not say anything to anyone until they're sure. Les has the phone to his ear.
Do you have a Herbert R. Tarlick, T-A-R-L-E-K, there as a patient? This is urgent. PDQ, Les Nessman, WKRP News here.
There's a pause.
Yes, I'll hold.
I had to think for a second about PDQ. Haven't heard that one in a long time. Pretty damn quick, but in your household...
At my house, it was pretty darn quick.
Yeah. Art and Andy enter the bullpen. Art's still upset at the comment Andy made about his fishing attire.
Well, I'll be up to my knees in the freezing Ohio. Now, is that silly?
Andy tells him it's not silly. He asks Art to entertain Jennifer and Les while he goes to gather the others.
You always entertain me, Mr. Carlson.
Art's a little embarrassed and speechless.
Back in the studio, Venus is at the mic. We hear Running Away by Maze, featuring Frankie Beverly, playing over the air. Johnny is practically laying on the console. Bailey is pacing around the studio, pleading her case.
You guys are afraid of me.
Oh, yeah.
Bailey tells them they're terrified to play a few hands of nickel-dime poker with a female. Johnny tells her, not really terrified.
I thought you were real men, but you're just... whipped.
Johnny tells Bailey it's Venus who's afraid, not him. The two of them begin arguing when there's a knock on the studio window. We see Andy in the hall, still carrying the present. Bailey turns and sees him motioning for her to come out into the hall. Bailey tells Venus and Johnny she'll see them at 9 o'clock and she'll bring the cards. Bailey leaves the studio as Johnny and Venus continue arguing.
How is Venus getting out of there at 9 p.m.? Is his show only 2 hours? He's always seemingly getting off work by 9 when an evening guy should really be on the air until at least 11, if not midnight.
It's WKRP time.
I guess. Venus, the early evening guy. The song we're hearing is called Running Away by the band Maze, featuring Frankie Beverly. Beverly had formed the band in 1970 under the kind of rough name Raw Soul. Marvin Gaye suggested the name change to Maze when they were touring with him in 1976. This cut is a studio track. It's one of 4 new studio tracks that were included on their 1981 album Live in New Orleans. Went to number 34 on the U.S. album chart. Running Away does not make the Hot 100, but it did score a number 7 spot on the U.S. R&B chart.
Oh, and look, we have a hallway poster watch.
Yay!
Andy and Bailey pass quickly through the hallway outside the studio on their way to the bullpen. The Yellow Jackets banner is still on the far wall. Under it is the Clash gatefold. Through the door at the end of the hall, we have Ricky Lee Jones. The one new thing we caught, the line of heads over the door. If you look above the door at the far end of the hall, there is a horizontal poster with a line of heads all looking to the left. This is a 1981 Commodores promo poster. It's one of the last promo items to be issued with Lionel Richie still as a member of the group. That's him to the far left. Okay, let's go on into the bullpen.
Andy tells Bailey to be enthusiastic as they walk into the bullpen. Venus and Johnny come out of the studio, following right behind Andy and Bailey.
All righty, folks. We have an occasion here before we all go off on our weekend.
Woo! All
right.
Not yet, Bailey. I now turn the festivities over to our head honcho, our numero uno, our own top dog, our fearless leader.
Art standing with his hands in his pockets, smiling, just kind of listening to what Andy's saying. Jennifer leans over and whispers, Andy is referring to him.
Mr. Carlson takes the present, and then he addresses the group.
Yeah, well, yes. Staff, I just wanted to say that it comes as no surprise to any of us here. Well, actually, no surprise to anybody in Cincinnati, really, who's within earshot of a transistor, that one of our own has distinguished himself in a distinguished way.
Mr. Carlson goes over to Les's desk and presents him with the gift. Les has a distant, dazed look. Until he's interrupted.
Do you mind? I'm on hold.
Jennifer tells Les she'll listen on the phone for him. Les gives the phone to Jennifer and walks over to Mr. Carlson.
We were thinking Les was hypnotized by the on hold music he was listening to. So Art holds the present out to Les.
You know, Les, it isn't every day that somebody wins that Nickel Niblet Award, so...
It's the Copper Cob, sir.
This is a callback to Date with Jennifer. When Les won the Silver Sow, no one got that name right either. They would blow the name, but keep the alliteration.
The Pink Porker.
So we've got your present here.
Mr. Carlson shoves the present into Les's stomach. He's not happy about being corrected. Les is thrilled.
It's so beautifully wrapped. Snakeskin and pigs.
Only Les would love snakeskin and pigs. He begins opening the gift.
Ooh, a simulated wood grain finish trophy case kit.
Bailey tells him all he needs now are some tools.
And a free month or two.
Carlson gives Johnny a stern look.
Fever.
But then he turns to Andy with the same question.
Is that it?
Mr. Carlson tells Les he has a plane to catch and Carlson has fish to catch. Bailey, Johnny, and Venus tell Les good job, he deserved it, and after some pats on the back, they all leave. Les is thrilled with his present. He's looking through the box.
Even the glue's included.
Andy tells Les congratulations, and he leaves. Jennifer, still at Les's desk, the phone to her ear.
Yes, still here. Oh? Is it serious? No, just a friend. Thank you anyway.
She hangs up the phone and tells Les...
You were right. He is in the hospital.
Who?
Wow. Remember the days when just anybody could call the hospital to inquire about a friend? Those days are no more. As of 1996, the HIPAA law made health information confidential. HIPAA stands for Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It's designed to protect patients from fraud and identity theft. It also guards against discrimination based on health issues.
HIPAA covers a lot of things, but the one most people know is the security clause. It forces healthcare providers to safeguard your health information. The upside, it really does work. It's reduced instances of healthcare-related fraud. The downside, when your old uncle calls the hospital to see how you're doing, if he's not on the list, they can't even tell him you're in the hospital. You can disclose anything you want, but healthcare workers can face some serious penalties if they talk about your condition.
And here's how much things have changed since about 1982. One of my Saturday morning responsibilities at the station in my hometown was to stop by the hospital at about 5:30 in the morning before I went in for sign-on. They would give me a list of everyone who had been admitted to the hospital the previous day, and we would read it on the air.
I remember that. I remember when that was a thing.
It was a regular part of the news. People listened for it. If you went into the hospital in Taylorville, Illinois in the early 80s, the whole town knew about it. We would even have people call to tell us if we missed announcing someone. The family wanted to hear Grandma's name on the radio.
After hearing about Herb, Les gets a concerned look on his face. Jennifer tries to reassure him. She says it could be any number of little things.
You know what a frightened man Herb is.
Well, I sure do. He's my best friend.
Jennifer puts her hand on Les's back, trying to be reassuring. She tells him when he gets home tomorrow, they'll both go visit Herb. Les is upset that Herb didn't say anything to him.
Well, I'm sure he didn't want to worry anyone. You know how thoughtful Herb is.
Thoughtful Herb? Whoa, it is really hard for Jennifer to get that out.
Jennifer tells Les she's sure it's nothing.
Jennifer, this is one time I wish I weren't fully cocked.
Jennifer quickly pulls her hand away from Les's back.
Okay, gang, we're going to get into Les's comment delicately. The half-cocked joke is a junior high-level homophone, so, of course, this is going to make the FCC all offended. Yes, cock is a fairly raunchy slang term for male genitalia, but it's also a verb used to talk about preparing a gun for firing, and it's the name used for a lot of male birds.
But there are some two-way words, those double-meaning words. Remember the ones you giggled at in sixth grade?
And the cock crowed three times.
Hey, the cock crowed three times. Hey, it's in the Bible.
Surprise, surprise, the use of cock as a reference to the male unit is the oldest of the three. Usage goes back to the 15th century. It was so commonly used by the 1890s in the crude form, the puritanical Victorians refused to use the term even to reference a rooster. They avoided any compound use of the word. Etymologists think avoiding the homophone is why terms like haycock for a haystack and weathercock for a weather vane fell out of usage about this time.
The connection to a gun is vague, but the cock of a firearm was first defined in print in 1745. Half-cocked referenced a gun where the cock had been lifted to the first catch, at which position the trigger does not act. By 1833, the phrase going off half-cocked had been adopted both in print and speech to figuratively mean speaking or acting too hastily. Going into a fight with a gun that was half-cocked meant you thought you were ready to do battle, but then you'd find the gun wouldn't work.
Okay, we did that, and I don't think we need to check the explicit box on this week's show.
Hopefully. Hopefully we'll get away with that.
We transition to a hospital room where Herb is sitting on a bed in a hospital gown. He has his hand on his chest, and he's feeling his heartbeat. He's also checking the pulse in his wrist when there's a knock on the door. A young lady in a nurse's uniform enters. Herb asks if she's a nurse.
Almost.
Herb asks if he looks sick.
Gee, it's hard to tell.
Do I look like a man who needs an operation?
Can I tell you something?
Sure.
This is my first week on the job.
The nurse is being played by Bonnie Urseth. Hugh Wilson likes his old ladies really old and his nurses very young. Remember Andy's candy striper from The Baby? At least this nurse did get a credit. The nurse who spoke at the end of God Talks to Johnny didn't get her name in the credits.
Hi, you got a doctor fever here.
Dr. Fever? What is that, a joke?
Although Bonnie looks like she's 12, she just had her 30th birthday the previous August. Originally from Minnesota, this is Bonnie's very first credit in her IMDb profile. This is a recurring character who will be back in the next episode, Who's On First?
Bonnie stayed busy in the 80s with guest shots. She did land a regular series spot in 1983 on the NBC sitcom We Got It Made. She appeared in all 22 episodes of the single season comedy. Bonnie did guest shots on several half hours and hours into the mid-90s. She appears to have taken 10 years off from 1995 until 2005. In 2005, she appeared on the series Medium, and that would be it for Bonnie's IMDb credits. In a fun career bookend, Bonnie started her career in 1981, credited as nurse here on WKRP. 25 years, 28 credits, and more than 50 episodes later, she would finish her career, also credited as nurse. And these are the only two nurse parts she ever played.
Herb puts his hand to his head and he sits back down on the bed.
Don't worry. I don't have to know about illnesses and junk. Since I'm new, they make me do all the icky stuff and deal with the jerky patients. Here.
Nothing icky here. So, guess we know how Herb is classed as a patient.
She holds out a small tray with little containers of pills on it.
You're supposed to take these so you sleep.
What are these?
Pills.
Herb looks at the young lady.
Bye. Any chance is my wife still here?
And I love this gag. The nurse looks around the room, then back to Herb.
No.
This is a pretty good gag. Hugh Wilson doesn't seem to have a very high opinion of healthcare workers, does he?
No, he slams them pretty hard. The young nurse tells Herb she'd like to stay and chat, but...
I have to give a basketball player a sponge bath.
She makes a little face and leaves the room. She gives Herb a little smile before closing the door. Herb dumps the pills into his hand. He starts to put them into his mouth, but then reconsiders. He puts the pills back into the little plastic cup.
Herb goes to his closet. When he turns his back to the camera, we get a butt shot of Herb's boxer shorts. So there's your answer to the question, does Herb wear boxers or briefs?
He's a boxer man.
He gets his pants out of the closet and he quickly puts them on. He is struggling with his pants zipper when there's a knock on the door. Herb jumps back into bed and covers up with the sheet. The door opens to reveal Les. He has a scarf over his mouth and nose, and he's carrying a suitcase. Les looks at the sheet-covered shape in the bed. He's completely covered. That doesn't look good.
Les Nessman, international man of mystery. His face covered. So Herb sits up, and it's kind of scary. The covers come up with him.
And in his head, Les thinks Herb's a goner.
Oh, it's some kind of a ghost coming up out of the bed. Seeing Les, Herb smiles and spreads his arms.
Lester, old buddy! What are you doing here?
Herb asks if anyone saw him. They wouldn't even let Lucille stay. Les tells Herb he snuck in. He covers his face with his scarf to demonstrate.
You sneaky, dirty dog, you.
That's me.
Herb asks Les how he knew he was there.
It's my job to know things, Herb.
Well, it's the cheapest hospital in town. Herb gets a worried look on his face.
You didn't tell anybody. I mean, you didn't tell Carlson or Andy.
Not Carlson or Andy.
Herb tells Les to come on over and sit down. He pats the bed.
Herb looks at the suitcase. He tells Les he thought he was supposed to be in Omaha.
Well, that flight you booked me on doesn't leave till 3 a.m.
Oh, yeah. That's a nice flight, Les.
That's a nice flight.
Oh. Les asks Herb why he didn't tell him about this hospital stay. Herb brushes it off as no big deal. You know how doctors are.
You know how people go off half-cocked?
A call back, and wow, they are really baiting the FCC with this one.
Herb gets up on his knees on the bed. He tells Les to look at him.
Do I look healthy? Better than you.
Herb slaps Les on the back pretty hard. He tells Les to go ahead and hit him in the stomach.
Oh, Herb.
No, I mean it. Just go.
Les hits Herb in the stomach as he's talking.
Well, you said to do it, Herb.
Herb falls onto the bed, holding his stomach and moaning. Les asks him if he's all right.
You don't look so good now.
And Les said that with a little grin. Herb's quiet for a moment, then he tells Les why he's there, and he gets kind of serious here.
You want to run some tests on my heart? You think something's wrong.
This really changes the mood of the room. Les sinks down to sit on the edge of Herb's bed.
You can hit me back if you want to, Herb.
Herb looks at him and smiles.
Maybe later, Les.
On kind of a serious note, the screen fades to black.
Frank Bonner just changing, boom, and go into that serious, dramatic acting. Herb had better be careful. Taking a punch in the stomach is what killed Harry Houdini. Houdini had been speaking to a group of college students at a lecture in Montreal on October 29th of 1926. He mentioned the strength of his stomach muscles and how they could withstand hard blows. It was a regular challenge of Houdini's to let audience members hit him in the stomach to show off his stomach muscles. One of the students punched Houdini twice in the stomach quickly without giving Houdini time to prepare. The blow ruptured his appendix and poisoned his system. He died 2 days later in a Detroit hospital on Halloween of 1926. The cause of death was peritonitis.
I mean it. Just go.
We faded to a commercial break. When we come back, we're still in Herb's hospital room. Herb is pacing back and forth, talking to Les, who is now sitting on the bed.
I think they're crazy. I mean, my heart is as good as the day it was born.
Les tells Herb he seems okay. Herb's trying to rationalize. He says everybody gets pains in their chest. Hold on a minute. Pains in their chest?
I mean, I didn't want to go to see the doctor. I knew it was the pizza. But no.
Lucille says, go on, Herb. Go on.
That's a big deal.
We love hearing Herb do a Lucille impersonation.
Over here.
Herb tells Les now they're going to probe and cut and stick a lot of tubes in him. He also says they're going to fill him with atomic stuff, which brings us to...
the line of the episode.
I tell you, Les, the next time I have guests, I'm not telling anybody.
Just keeping my mouth shut.
Herb mentioned getting filled with atomic stuff for his heart. In the 1970s and 80s, we were just on the horizon of nuclear medicine being used in the diagnosis and treatment of several diseases. In 1974, the American Osteopathic Board of Nuclear Medicine was established, and nuclear medicine became its own specialized field. In the 1980s, the very first radiopharmaceuticals were developed for use in the diagnosis of heart disease. This is probably what Herb's worried about.
He's also worried about everything leaking. Remember that? It all leaks.
Yeah, it all leaks.
Besides, I read somewhere that solar energy is dangerous. It leaks or something.
It's nuclear energy that leaks?
Everything leaks. Water, oil, you name it. It's the nature of things.
Les asks him if he feels okay now. Herb does a couple of jumping jacks to show Les he feels fine. Herb's convinced doctors only find things wrong with you so they can make money. Herb takes off the hospital gown and puts his shirt on. He tells Les he's getting out of there.
Anybody wants to cut me open, it is going to have to be in the middle of an alley.
Oh, that sounds a little harsh. Les tells Herb he can't just leave. Herb says Les has been right about doctors all along.
Please don't listen to me. Sometimes I don't know what I'm talking about. Right.
Even Les knows.
Doesn't keep him from talking.
No. Herb gets the rest of his things from the closet and then slowly opens the door to check the hallway. He turns back to Les. Well, Les hasn't moved. Herb asks Les if he's coming. Les wants to know where.
To be among the living, Les.
But I was going to Omaha.
Les, lying here tonight, I realize just how precious every second of life is. It's starting right now. This is one guy who's going to experience the wonder and beauty of life from a front row seat.
Herb walks out of the room and Les follows.
You know how Herb said Les has been right about doctors all along? It reminded us of Les's monologue in Frog Story. We heard an earful from Mr. Nessman when it came to the safety of U.S. health care.
Do you realize how many mistakes doctors make each year? I've got a report right here about a doctor who sewed up his Timex inside a patient. You see stories like that every day. Wildly incorrect diagnoses, wrong limbs being removed. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
What are you trying to tell me, Nessman?
Do you realize how little doctors know? Wise up, John. Come to think of it, when somebody goes, usually the last person he was with was a doctor.
The madcap manic movement of this episode continues. I think about the poor set people after going over this script. Okay, you're going to need a hospital room. Then we're going to need a theater because we begin this scene hearing the audio of racy-sounding saxophone music playing under a male and female. They seem to be speaking in a foreign language. I believe I heard her say Dieter.
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 We are in a theater. Les peeks through some dark curtains. He walks on into the darkened theater. He's carrying popcorn and a pair of cardboard 3D glasses. And it's kind of that TV darkness thing. To Les, it's really, really dark. He can't see anything, but we can see everybody in the theater. Les is looking for Herb after he taps a stranger on the shoulder, thinking it's Herb.
Hey.
He finally finds Herb and has a seat. Herb tells Les he missed the best part. I don't know how Herb knows that unless he's seen this one before.
Do you know what kind of theater this is?
Herb tells him absolutely he knows what kind of theater it is and continues watching the film.
I don't even want to think what the best part of that movie was. Unless you grew up in the 1960s and 70s, you may not know what kind of theater this is. Urban Les are in what was called an adult, erotic, or pornographic theater. Usually the name was shortened to porn theater or porno house. These theaters were devoted to showing nothing but hardcore, triple X-rated movies. The earliest erotic theaters in the United States appeared in California in the late 1950s. They showed 35mm low-budget independently produced stag films. In 1960, there were a total of about 20 theaters in the U.S. showing erotic movies exclusively.
And more than half of those were in California. By the late 1960s, that number had jumped to more than 750 porn theaters around the country. Small storefront theaters with about a dozen seats had sprung up in questionable neighborhoods of major cities. The films of this era were primarily shot in 16mm with minimal production values. Before Rudy Giuliani became mayor of New York and started his big cleanup effort, the Times Square area was New York City's largest adult theater district. The Martin Scorsese movie Taxi Driver is set in the porn theater district of Manhattan.
The early 1980s growth of VCR ownership cut deeply into the porn movie theater business. Owners tried to form chains to reduce costs. It didn't take the theater owners long to realize nobody wanted to watch porn in a group when you could watch it in the privacy of your own home.
Yuck.
You didn't even have to buy it. You could rent it in the back room of your local video store. By the late 1980s, the internet was also starting to deliver porn directly to people's desktops. By 1989, the number of porn theaters in the U.S. had fallen to below 250. These days, 65 remain, and they're all owned by the Deja Vu Exotic Dance Club chain.
Doing the research for this one reminded me of a 400-level class I had in college in media. It was independent study, so I was working for a professor and just going out and doing research. He had a theory it was porn that helped VHS win the format wars. VHS beat out Beta as a home format, even though Beta had the better picture and sound. My prof believed porn was responsible, and I was supposed to somehow prove it. I had to go find articles talking about the rise of VCRs and their importance in getting porn to people. It was the weirdest thing to go into the library on campus and be finding all this really seedy, seamy stuff. But some of it was reported in Billboard magazine and some of it was in broadcasting, but some of it was in some really questionable publications.
Well, seeing deja vu, there's a deja vu that we would pass on the highway. And whose name was on the
sign? Yes, one of the featured dancers that we got a real kick out of was Heidi Hooters.
Heidi Hooters.
Heidi Hooters was appearing at the deja vu. Classy establishment.
And we think that Mr. and Mrs. Hooters were very
proud. So
yes.
Proud of young Heidi.
Heidi Hooters.
So Les is looking at the screen and eating his popcorn, but he does not have his glasses on.
It's all fuzzy.
Herb tells him, it's 3D. You've got to put on the glasses.
It's just like they're in the same room.
Just after he says this, everyone in the theater ducks quickly to their right, including Herb. It is the funniest visual, especially with those 3D glasses on and seeing them all dodge to the right.
What do you think they're dodging?
I don't even want to consider that. I don't even want to think about that. So Herb laughs. Les puts his glasses on. Now he looks at the screen and begins to chuckle for just a second. Suddenly, Les sees something really shocking. He puts his hand up to cover the screen. He rips the 3D glasses off. Now he's looking down at the floor. Les leans over to Herb. He tells Herb he's been thinking about those heart tests. He wants Herb to get a second opinion.
If not from a doctor, then from a friend, like Mr. Carlson.
Herb looks at Les.
Carlson? Or Andy?
Travis?
Herb tells Les to think. He asks Les, when he hears heart operation, what's the first thing that pops into his mind?
Shogun. Shogun. Dr. Kildare was in it.
Herb tells Les that Carlson and Andy will think their gung-ho, hardball salesman can only handle slow pitch. He tells Les no thanks. The man sitting behind Herb and Les leans forward.
Am I going to have to get the manager?
And I just noticed he's wearing a trench coat.
Oh,
the perfect 70s perv accessory.
Herb tells Les to enjoy the movie. After, they'll go for a pizza and then go bowling.
Crazy fun can go on forever.
Wow, sometimes it's a little scary to look at how Les's mind works. Let's back up a second and decipher the news beacon. First off, he mentioned Shogun, all right? Shogun was a monumental 9-hour, 5-episode miniseries produced in 1980. It aired over 5 consecutive nights, starting on September 15th of 1980. Shogun was based on James Clavell's book of the same name about the adventures of an English ship pilot in 17th century Japan. Both the book and the miniseries were huge hits.
Okay, now let's see if we can tie this back to heart surgery.
Yeah, let's see you do this.
Richard Chamberlain starred as the English pilot John Blackthorne in Shogun. Chamberlain had also played the dashing and brilliant Dr. Kildare in the 1961 series of the same name. Chamberlain played Kildare, who specialized in internal medicine for 5 seasons and 191 episodes of the series. There we go. Les's chain of logic is proven.
You know, there was a 15-year difference between when Kildare went off the air and Shogun came on, but Les is still holding on to those memories of Kildare. They don't ever refer to him by name, but the obnoxious guy in the trench coat is referred to as Buzzy in the IMDb listing for this episode. We're wondering if Buzzy might be an all-purpose name the writers use for obnoxious guys on WKRP. You remember Delos V. Smith played the character Buzzy Milker in the Pilot Part 2 episode.
I'm not as old as I look.
Buzzy is being played by comic character actor John Brent. Brent did several movies in the 1960s and early 70s. He was in Catch-22, The Candidate, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, and American Graffiti. Out of a dozen acting credits, this guest shot on WKRP is one of only 2 sitcom appearances, and there might be a reason for that.
The Committee Connection.
John was a member of The Committee, the San Francisco-based improv troupe that launched Howard Hessman. John really got into improv. He was also a member of the Second City improv troupe.
Unfortunately, John died young. We're not sure what happened, but we did find his obituary. John died in August of 1985 at the age of 47. Whatever it was must have been sudden. On the day before he died, John was listed in the LA Weekly as performing with Sills & Company all that week. Sills & Company was an improv troupe created by Second City co-founder Paul Sills. Notable names in the company who were performing alongside John Brent? Some folks we know, Hamilton Camp, Valerie Harper, Rachel McKinnon, Richard Shaw, and Avery Schreiber.
We hear some voices coming from the entrance. Bailey and Andy enter the theater. Bailey is holding Andy's arm. They're followed closely by Venus and Johnny.
I can't see anything. I'm not sure I want to see anything.
I think I've seen enough. Bailey, let's get out of here.
Bailey turns to speak to Johnny.
John, would you stop it? I am not a child. If you haven't noticed, I'm a full-grown woman.
There's an audible movement. Everyone in the theater turns to look at them coming down the aisle.
Oh, yeah. Did we mention porn theaters were attended almost exclusively by men?
I had to call him, Herb. Please don't be mad at me.
Andy spots Les and Herb. He crawls over the seats to get to Herb, asking if he's all right. Herb stands up.
Look, I'm just trying to live my life to the fullest and the best way I know how.
Herb is looking back at the others as he said this. The man in the trench coat behind Herb and Les stands up.
Well, so am I, so would you shut up?
Well, they are in a theater, after all. They scramble to find seats. Bailey sits in the row behind Les and Herb, and for some reason she sits next to the man who's been telling them to shut up. Johnny leans over Bailey to ask him,
can you move over one?
They are all finally settled and seated.
Johnny is clearly uncomfortable having Bailey in the theater.
Hey guys, why don't we take Bailey on out of here and play a couple more rounds of poker, huh?
Because we're here to save Herb's life.
Bailey, don't put those glasses on.
Don't be so... Oh my goodness.
Everyone in the theater once again ducks to their right.
They are getting a lot of mileage out of the 3D thing.
Next, we hear Mr. Carlson's voice calling out for Les. He's a bit late to the party. Johnny waves Mr. Carlson over.
Do you have any idea what kind of a theater this is?
Buzzy sits forward and answers Carlson's question.
Yes, very loud.
Okay, so we pointed out a minute ago this was a porn theater. We didn't mention it's also a 3D theater. This seems to be a seedy bit of 70s trivia. Here's the thing. We were able to find 3D theaters going back to the 1950s, and we found porn theaters very extensively in the 60s and 70s. We could not find a reference to a 3D porn theater, or even really a 3D porn film produced in the 1970s or 80s. Now, we don't think Hugh Wilson and Company made it up. We're pretty sure this was out there. We just couldn't find the documentation.
An article about the evolution of 3D mentioned 70s-era pornos being produced in StereoVision 3D, but they didn't list titles. If there were 3D porn films in the 70s and 80s, we're sorry to report their legacy is lost, at least in our research.
Oh.
We did find a film made in 2011 in Hong Kong that was widely heralded as being the first 3D porn movie. It was called 3D Sex and Zen. If you'd like to do some further investigation into the topic, a company called Something Weird has 70s-era porn movies available on DVD.
And if you should do this reference, we really don't want to know about it. Bailey tells Carlson to sit down. Art squeezes into the same row as Johnny, Bailey, and Buzzy. He finds a seat on the other side of Buzzy.
Herb, what is this about you and your heart and atomic waste?
He points at Les and says he's going to kill him. Herb tells Carlson there's nothing more he can say that hasn't already been said by Les. Suddenly, there's a lot of commotion in the theater. It's a raid. We don't see any cops because they'd have to pay cops, but we understand they're being busted. People begin scrambling out. Johnny stands up. And Johnny's first response is to start emptying his jeans pockets. He's throwing their contents just randomly on the floor away from him. He seems to have a few things on him he'd rather not have found by the cop.
Oh, boy. Here we go again.
We transition to a jail cell where Bailey, Herb, Les, Venus, Johnny, Mr. Carlson, Andy, and Buzzy from the theater are all sitting on benches in a dark holding room. Johnny is asleep on one of the benches. He can sleep anywhere.
Anywhere.
A worried Bailey asks the others if they think they will all be fingerprinted.
Bailey Quarters, summa cum laude, Ohio State. Sex pervert.
Herb pipes up.
I'd like to mention that all this is Les's fault.
Mine?
Why didn't you just mind your own business and go to Omaha?
Omaha. Omaha seems like a dream to me now.
Omaha was also the travel punchline when Johnny was trying to get away in Till Debt Do Us Part.
Ooh, Nebraska. I'd love to go to Omaha. It's one of our nation's leading pork packing centers.
We're not sure why Omaha has suddenly gotten the writer's attention, but it seems to have taken the heat off of Philadelphia, at least for a while.
More madcap movement. Oh, yeah, we also need a jail cell. The poor set people. Oh, and summa cum laude is an honorary title used by educational institutions. It's Latin for with highest distinction. Way to go, Bailey. The door to the holding cell opens, and Jennifer walks in.
Thank you, Mel. And I thought I was having an interesting evening.
Jennifer is speaking to the never-seen jailer, Mel. Okay, seriously, who doesn't Jennifer know?
Well, you were saying that maybe Jennifer just met Mel that night, but
right,
people become close to Jennifer very quickly.
Men, especially.
Men, especially, yes.
Oh, you want me to let these guys out? Okay, I'll unlock the door.
I'll do whatever you say. Jennifer is wearing a black low-cut evening gown, and she's carrying a white mink wrap. Art looks at Jennifer and apologizes.
I'm sorry, Jennifer. I don't know who else to call.
Well, you sure made the right choice.
Jennifer looks at Les.
Les, I thought we were going to go visit Herb together.
Les kind of looks dejectedly back at Jennifer.
Well, it doesn't really matter, Jennifer. I missed my flight to Omaha, and
Herb's going to drop over dead.
Les is glaring at Herb as he says this.
Herb gets up and walks over to Les. He tells Les to not try and scare him.
All they want to do is test my heart.
What, to see if you have one?
Herb looks at them all.
Why don't you people just leave me alone?
Because, Herb, it's a natural impulse to throw a rope to a drowning man, even if he doesn't have enough sense to grab it.
Buzzy, the man from the theater, pipes up.
Yeah, Herb, why don't you have the heart test? Don't be a jackass.
Herb looks at all of them, and he thanks them, and he says he appreciates it, but it's his life and his risk, and he'll take the chance.
I'm a gambling man.
A couple of observations on this group in the jail cell. Okay, why were they the only ones caught? Everybody else in that theater got away. Just this group got caught.
Well, maybe they're in another room.
Well, that could possibly be. But also, this is a pretty lax jail. Bailey's got her purse, and they've all got their personal belongings with them.
But when the raid happened, everybody took off, but this group just kind of
stayed there,
hunkered down in their seat.
Bailey keys in on Herb's gambling man comment and leans in towards him.
You're a gambling man, Herb? Okay. Let's gamble.
Bailey reaches into her purse and pulls out a deck of cards.
How about we cut the deck?
What?
If you win, you get the $200 I made off of these guys. But if I win, you take those tests?
Interesting move on Bailey's part. Herb tells Bailey she's nuts. Andy tells Herb it's a good idea. He says he'll even kick in an extra 2 weeks' vacation.
How macho is the man in the Earl Shive suit?
$5.
Johnny kicks in $5. Venus adds 20. Herb tells them all he's still not going to do it.
Earl Shive didn't have anything to do with suits, but he is synonymous with cheap and good enough. Earl Shive is famous for painting cars, but he didn't start out that way. In the early 1930s, Shive opened a gas station and garage at Whitworth and Fairfax in Los Angeles. His neighbors and customers started asking if he knew anyone who could paint their cars. Earl saw a chance at some side money. After hours, Shive started painting cars in the lube bay of the garage.
It didn't take long before the paint business was much more lucrative than the mechanic business. Shive sold the garage and started painting cars full-time. By the 1950s, Shive had a string of paint shops in 23 states, and they were all using Shive paint in the Shive paint system. Shive himself had become a minor celebrity. He appeared in hundreds of his own low-budget commercials, which he ran on late-night TV. His pitch? I'll paint any car, any color, for $29.95, no ups, no extras. That price did go up over the years. By the 1980s, the price was $99.95, but the pitch was still the same.
Right, I'll paint any car for just $99.95.
Shive continued to do his own commercials until his death in 1992.
And I believe you had one of your DJ vans painted by Mr. Shive.
I had an ancient Dodge van, and I didn't go for the $99.95. That was the basic. I did the deluxe, which was $149.95.
Oh, hey, and you know, big spender.
For $150, it was not a bad paint job.
The gang is not getting through to Herb. Jennifer decides to get involved.
Maybe I can sweeten the pot a little.
Jennifer slowly wiggle walks her way over to Herb.
Herb, if Bailey draws the high card, you take the tests. If you draw the high card, you and I will have an evening on this town you will never forget. That's all I'm saying.
And she slides her hand softly across his face as she goes back to where she was standing. Venus puts the cards up next to Herb's face and shuffles the deck right at him. The look on Venus's face is hilarious. Herb tells Bailey she can cut first. Bailey hesitates and then takes the deck.
Come on, Bailey, I'm really counting on you.
Venus looks like a kid on a playground between two other kids that
are
going to
fight. And
he's like, come on, let's fight. Come on. He's just so excited about this confrontation. Bailey holds the deck up near Herb's face. They all gather around Bailey and Herb. Bailey cuts the deck and they all moan. Bailey looks back over to Jennifer.
I'm sorry, it's a four.
Thanks to Canadian WKRP blogger and friend of the podcast, Roy Penny, for pointing out Bailey's slip here. She lets us see her card. Roy has identified it as a two of clubs. We'll agree it's a two, but our TV wasn't so clear as to let us see a suit. Smiling, Herb says, it's his turn. He jerks his wrist back and snaps his fingers. Then he pulls a card from near the top of the deck. He looks at it. Everyone is standing, waiting.
Well?
Jennifer asks with a concerned look on her face. Herb hesitates, but he doesn't show the card.
Can't even beat a lousy four. It's the kind of luck I seem to have.
Herb, can I see that card?
Herb didn't sound all that convincing.
Herb quickly slides the card back into the deck, not letting anyone see it.
Well, Herbert, I believe you have some tests waiting.
Jennifer tells Herb to come on. She'll bail him out. Jennifer knocks on the door and calls for her old buddy Mel.
The unseen Mel.
The door opens and Jennifer walks out. Herb gets to the door and then looks down at Les.
Thanks. Les. Buddy.
Herb hits Les on the arm, playfully, but maybe still a bit too hard. Les jumps and puts his hand up defensively. Then he sees Herb is smiling. Les smiles back and waves. Herb walks out and closes the door. They all applaud, and then they sit down. After a few seconds, we hear...
What about the rest of us?
They realize Herb's good fortune doesn't apply to them. Everyone jumps up and runs to the door.
Well, Mel!
They were all just relaxing there until they realized, hey, we're in jail. Herb should not be taking those tests lightly. According to CDC statistics for 2018, heart disease is responsible for 1 in 4 U.S. deaths annually. That's about 660,000 deaths each year. Men are more at risk than women, but everybody is at risk and should get those tests. That is going to do it for Straight from the Heart, but we've got more of this story to tell next week. What is our episode, Donna?
Next week, we'll be talking about Who's On First. The ongoing story arcs continue in season 4. With Herb in the hospital, Mr. Carlson must fill in for him in order to negotiate a contract. But if Mr. Carlson is Herb, who's Mr. Carlson? In the meantime, Johnny avoids settling a poker debt, and lobby construction continues.
That's going to do it for this episode of the WKRP Cast. If you'd like to watch along with us, just check our show notes. We've got all the details in there. Also, find us on social media. We're having a lot of fun on Facebook. You can find our Facebook page at WKRP Cast. For more WKRP fun, you can become a patron. Go to patreon.com/WKRPcast. We've got all kinds of behind-the-scenes fun, full interviews, and more for our patrons.
Got a question, comment, or correction? Let us know about it. We love reading your comments. Write us WKRPcast@gmail.com.
And as always, remember to please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Bye now.
May the good news be yours.
The WKRP Cast is not endorsed by MTM Enterprises, Shout Factory, or CBS. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. WKRP in Cincinnati, the WKRP logo, and all names, pictures, and audio of WKRP in Cincinnati characters are registered trademarks of MTM, CBS, Shout Factory, or their respective copyright holders.
Almost forgot, fellow babies. Booger!